the problem. Evening service, people start falling asleep. And I have been known to throw things at people and do whatever I need to embarrass them to get them to wake up. Tonight is different. It was such a nice day out today that if you're falling asleep in here, because even if I'm really good, boring or not, you've got measure to fall asleep tonight. I won't even give you a hard time because I just take it that means you were out playing and having a good time out in God's creation today. Man, what an amazing day. So, wow. Thanks for coming tonight. A couple of announcements here before we get started. First of all, there is a table out in the lobby that the women's ministry has, and there's a couple things that they have going on out there I'll let you know about. The first thing is there is a women's retreat. They go to Silver Spur each year. This year it's May 18th through the 20th, about a month away here. The cost is $144. You want to find out who's speaking and who's going, answer any of the questions you may have about that. They'll have somebody out there. I think Laura will be out there at that table tonight, and happy to give you any information about the retreat that they're doing. And then periodically throughout the year, they do Bible studies on Thursday nights. They're starting a new series in the book of Philippians, and they're going to start this Thursday night on the 26th. It's an 8-week series. They meet on Thursdays, 6:30 to 8:30, and the books are $6. I think they have the books out there at the table, so you can stop by out there and take a look at the books. And again, any questions that you may have about that stuff, they'd be happy to be able to answer any questions you have about that stuff. One of the neat ministries we have here at the church is this bilingual ministry where we're helping people in our community that want to become more proficient in their English skills. And so we match them with tutors. I think we've got 24 tutors right now working with folks. And we are looking specifically, like right now, I mean, we're always looking for more people to help out in that. But there is a real need for 4 more ladies to help out. And if you're interested, you can call the office. We'll put you in contact with Pat Posada, who runs the ministry. One of the things that's really cool about this is first of all, if you're like me, and you know my English isn't even that good, and I don't speak any Spanish. So if you don't speak any Spanish, that's fine. You actually don't have to speak any, which is a fantastic thing about the program. And then secondly, you get to kind of set the hours. It's a 6-month commitment to start, but I don't know anybody that's just done it for 6 months of the people that have started. But it's a 6-month commitment, and you know it's flexible according to your schedule. So if you want to find out more about it, you can call the office. If you call the office during the week, ask for Barbara in the office, because Barbara's been doing this for 2 years or more with one of the ladies that she's been working with. And man, it's been amazing to see the work that they've done. But Barbara can give you sort of a firsthand, what's this really like? Sort of an insight from her work of doing this over the last couple of years. So you're interested in that kind of in helping out in those regards. You know what? I put it at the bottom of their training, November Saturday. That's a long ways away, isn't it? Would have been good if I had thought about that and deleted that from last time I used that. All right. I've never in my life wanted to be like really thought about being a junior high girl or a senior high girl, but this event really made me think. You know what? There might be some merit to. I may have to fake it and dress up here and see if I can pull it off, but they're doing a chocolate party night this Friday night at the Novak's house from 6 to 8:30. They got all sorts of games and fun things that they do over there. One of the things that they do is whatever the theme is they kind of tie it into some sort of, you know, Bible lesson. I'm still trying to figure out where are they going to go in the scripture to talk about chocolate and do their Bible lesson, but they're going to have a chocolate party over there. Any questions you may have, you want to get in touch with Rebecca, you can call the office. We'll give you her number. There are some other flyers around the church, and you can look on the flyers because those have her number on there also. Last week, I bragged about a couple of the parents that were here that I ran into up at Heavenly on Sunday afternoon, who their kids had won the events that they were doing in skiing and snowboarding. It was a cool opportunity to brag about their kids and give them a hard time about their kids not being here. Well, another kid that's not here tonight that has a good excuse not being here, because she is the world champion in half pipe skiing. She won today up at Whistler. Maddie Bowman, and Sue is back here today. Where's Sue? Sue, you're high. There's Sue. How exciting is that? Maddie, who's a senior, that's from the front page of ESPN, and I was up here. I just cut this out and put this up here. And but if you go to the front page of their one of their sports pages, she's on there. They actually have a video of her run. Did you get to see her run already, Sue? On the web? It's on the web already, and you can watch it. So, anyways, that's pretty cool. Neat feather in your cap. You know, tell me this is not like classic mom. So I'm talking to her, and I say, oh, that's a, you know, that's how cool is that? What an amazing thing. She goes, you know what? I'm just happy to get the call that she landed everything and that she's safe. You know, forget winning the world championship. I'm just glad my dollar is safe from doing all those flips. That's pretty cool. So that's outstanding. All right, we've got a great kids program already. Go downstairs. So kids, you can be dismissed. If you are new here tonight, Miss Hillary is over here. She'd love to get to know you and be able to introduce you and your child to the classes that we have down there. And for the rest of you, why don't you take a minute and stand up and say hi to somebody near you tonight. Is that my office? And there's four spaces between the five knots, obviously. And the four spaces remind you of the four holy letters of the name of God. And so this was a visible symbol, a visible reminder for them of God. The Old Testament has 613 different commands that they thought were the commands to obey. These knots are made up, the five big knots on each corner are actually made up of smaller knots, and the number of knots happens to be 613 on each one of this. And this was their visible reminder, a way for them to take seriously what God said, or a way to remember who he was and what he's all about. Now, what's interesting about this is this word, it's a Hebrew word that's used for corner, and it's kanaf, and it means edge or borders. It's used a couple times in the Bible, like to talk about the edge or boundary of a country or a nation. But it's also the same word that's used to talk about the edges of this garment. Now, what's really interesting about this is if you read in the prophets, they came to sort of this belief or this understanding that when the Messiah would come, that not only would he have real healing power in his touch, in his physical touch, but they even came to believe that there would be healing in his clothes. And the way that they express that is they talked about that there would be healing in his wings. Now, it's not hard to understand how they'd come to that conception, because if you're wearing one of these and you're walking around, what happens to the edges of the garment? They flow out. What do they look like? They look like wings, right? And so if you have your Bibles and you open up to the very last book of the Old Testament, which is the famous prophet, he's an Italian guy named Malachi, and... come on, that's funny too. Help me out here, guys. Malachi chapter 4, last chapter of the Old Testament. Malachi expresses this idea. He says, "But for you who revere my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings." Now, they believe somehow that within the person, the Messiah, within his clothes that he wore, there would be healing. And you could understand why they get that picture. Here's the interesting thing. That word, kanaf, that you see there talking about borders, is also the word that they use for wings. Imagine that. So there was this belief that they had that somehow within not just his physical touch, but even just within his clothes, that people could be relieved of their suffering, that there would be power in it. Wow. Okay, what does that have to do with our story in Mark? Well, it'd be good detectives when we work through here, you'll find out. But let's start by reading in verse 21 of the book of Mark, and we'll work through this together and see what God has for us here tonight. Great stories. One thing I'll tell you, normally over the last several Sundays, people come in here and we've had different people read the passage for you so you know sort of what we're talking about. I'm not going to do that tonight. Tonight I'm going to work through this kind of little chunks at a time. And the reason I'm doing that is because these two stories are so rich, and I think part of what happens is we become familiar with them, and probably as I start talking about this, most of you will know these stories. And so there's a tendency that because we know the beginning, we know the middle, and especially we know the end, that it's very easy to forget the details of the people involved in here. And so I want to walk through this kind of slowly with you today and hope that you'll, as we do this, hopefully it'll be an opportunity for you to, before you just think about the end, to be able to think about what the real life challenges that each one of these people was faced with. So it starts in verse 21 by telling us, Mark tells us, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. And so remember last week I showed you a map as to where all this stuff took place. And this is that the northern part of the land that we call Israel today, up around that's the lake is the Sea of Galilee. Most of Jesus' ministry happened up in kind of the northwestern area of that, what's called the area, the Galilean region. And these four stories that we've read over the last 3 weeks, John started 3 weeks ago about telling us how Jesus crossed the lake. He was going from Capernaum down to the southeastern part of the lake. That's where that huge storm happens and everybody freaks out. Jesus is asleep in the boat. And they wake him up and he calms the storm and they're terrified that Jesus has got this power. Last week I talked about how he goes down there and he's met by this crazy guy that no one can restrain. He's been possessed by these evil forces and it's wreaked havoc in his life in so many ways. Jesus brings deliverance to him. So today we find out Jesus is going back across the lake, back up to the northern part of the country, back up into where all the, primarily where the Jews lived here. And so the thing that's fascinating about this is, don't miss this, is that Mark really emphasizes this, how popular Jesus is. Everywhere he goes, there's this crowd. And at the end of this verse 21, it tells us that you know, is when he gets across the lake. I mean, you think that you're pressed for time or people have high demands for you, you know, your spouse or your kids or the people at work, whatever. If your friends, you feel like you're in high demand and it gets frustrating to you. Can you imagine poor Jesus? It's no wonder this guy spent so much time in the boat because it was the only place he could go to get away from the crush of people. He's getting back across the lake, and even as he gets across the lake, somehow word has come that that's where he's going to be, and he's met right there by this crush of people. Whoa, can you imagine what this life was like for this guy? It goes on to tell us then that Jesus meets in this crowd of people. He meets the synagogue ruler. Then one of the synagogue rulers, a guy named Jairus, came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet, and he pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying." I'm not sure in life, at least for me as a parent, other than news about my wife like this, I'm not sure that there's anything that would get to the heart, you know, get me emotionally and put me in a place of desperation than to find out that my child or my wife was sick and dying. And the word in here is that death was intimate, that it was, they believed that she was going to die. And so he comes to Jesus. He says, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her that she'll be healed and that she'll live." This is his lifeline of hope, and Jesus responds, and Jesus goes with him. He follows him. And again, Mark reminds us, there's this huge crowd of people with him. Can you imagine, just for a minute, just be reminded of this dad comes to Jesus, desperate for help, lifeline, hoping to get, you know, some help here. And Jesus, the word here where it says he follows him, it means that he moved very intentionally. Let's go. You know, there's some urgency attached to this. Can you imagine that had to be such a huge boost for Jairus to know that Jesus cared about what was going on and that Jesus was interested enough in this guy to be able to come and help him? I want to look just real quickly here at this guy, Jairus, and talk just a little bit more about him in depth before we keep moving through the story here. His fear is very evident. Obviously, his big fear in all of this is his daughter is going to die, and he's scared to death about this. But there's another part of the story that I think is important to remember, and that is that probably a reason why he hasn't come to Jesus sooner is that he's got a very real fear about being associated with Jesus. The synagogue ruler he wasn't the rabbi, but the synagogue ruler was really, this was an elected position. It was like you go to church, and it's not necessarily the pastor, but if you got together and you elected a representative from the church that sort of helped run the church and was the liaison, you'd pick someone of standing, someone who'd been in the community, someone who knew other people, someone who had influence, someone with integrity. I mean, this was a big guy. Now, Jesus was very popular with the middle class people, and there was a large, you know, big percentage of the population that was what we'd consider, you know, the lower class of people. Jesus was very popular with those people because of the hope and the way that he was, you know, challenged the social structure of things. He was very popular with those people. The people Jesus was not very popular with were the people particularly of religious standing, because they had the most influence over the towns and the culture. They had the most prestige. They sort of set the rules. They were on the top of the social structure. And Jesus really came to challenge their authority and what they were doing with their leadership and made them very, very uncomfortable. And we know the further we go into Jesus' ministry, the more we find out that, you know what, Jesus was just not at all popular with these people. Jairus was certainly in that class. And for him to go to Jesus, he had to know his friends weren't going to look on him well for going to see Jesus to help. You know, they would have come to him and said, hey, you know what, you could have gone to so-and-so, or why didn't you go, you know, why didn't you, they would have encouraged him and questions, why didn't you go to someone else? He's the last guy that you should go to. And I think there's a good reminder here for us that in desperate times, sometimes we'll do things that otherwise we'd never consider doing. And I think that's definitely the case, a big part of what's going on with Jairus here. He really is desperate. He's at the end of his rope, and he believes that Jesus is my last hope to be able to do something here. I think a key to understanding Jairus and this whole situation is that desperation really does lead to, very often, to dependence upon God. And we might kind of poo-poo that and think it's a bad thing, but I think God allows us very oftentimes, and we'll find this out later in the story, God allows us to exhaust all the other options. And even at the end of that, finally then we'll come to a place where we're humble enough to say, you know what, you're in charge anyways. So you know what, please help me. And that's definitely where this guy is. He comes, he's at the end of his resources. He realizes his social standing, his religious standing with God, whatever financial resources he has, isn't going to buy the help that he needs. And so he comes and he does something very unseemly. He comes and he throws himself, a dignified person throws himself at the feet of Jesus and begs him for help. I think sometimes God allows us to get desperate so that we will come to the end of our rope and finally be willing to come to him in broken honesty. There's a lesson for us in all of this too that's important to grab a hold of, and that is that real faith in our life is demonstrated by our actions. A lot of times I think we talk about faith and it's sort of an abstract thing, like I have faith in whatever, that this will come to pass. And it's not really attached to any sort of concrete idea or choices that we make. The thing that's important to know about this is the Bible doesn't talk about faith as an abstract thing. Generally, the Bible talks about faith in the way we might think of what are your values, what are your priorities. See, your faith is demonstrated through the choices that you make in life, and your faith there ought to be evidence of your faith by the sort of choices that you make in life. Very oftentimes, we may say, "Oh, I believe this is true." But when push comes to shove, when you look at someone's actions, you can pretty much tell what they really believe about life. If you're desperate and you say, well, I believe in Jesus, he's my Lord and my King, but you go to everybody else and everything else as your options to get help and God last, you might ask yourself, do you really trust God first and foremost to meet all of your needs in life? See, your actions sometimes betray what you say you have faith in or what your belief is. Your choices oftentimes demonstrate where your real loyalties lie in life. There's a great scene in the movie Gladiator that shows how important this is. And Maximus, who's the gladiator, he's the hero of the movie. Very early on, he's the general, he's the champion, the Marcus Aurelius, who is the emperor, doesn't want his son to become the emperor, and he's trying to get Maximus to consider taking the job. And Commodus, his son, isn't happy about that because he wants to be emperor, comes along, murders his dad. And Maximus is put in a surprise position and he has to display through his choice where his loyalties are going to lie. And I want to show you this clip real quick. Oh. Sorry, Michael, I'm back up. We'll do it again. That's Commodus right there, the new emperor.
Your emperor asked for your loyalty, Maximus. Take my hand. I only offer it once.
If you know the movie and how this turns out for him, you sort of want to stop and go, just kiss the guy's hand. Because to reject showing your loyalty here costs him enormously. He loses his generalship. His family is slaughtered, brutally killed and burned. He loses his land. He loses everything that he has built, all the success, the achievements of his life are all stripped away from him, and he ends up becoming just a common slave. And you think to yourself, you go, wait a minute, it's not worth the trade here. But you see, what he was faced with was a choice of loyalties. Are you going to embrace this new emperor who represents something very different than what his father and the empire that his father had built represented? He had the choice. Where are you going to put your faith? What are your values that you're going to choose to live by? Where are they best representative? And here's the thing. See, the choices that we make in life about this stuff very oftentimes has very real consequences. I'm ashamed to say that there's been so many times in my life, both before I was a Christian, but even after I became a Christian, even after becoming a pastor, where, you know, the idea of what the sort of values and principles that are represented by my life and my commitment to Christ sometimes are challenged by other opportunities. And I have at times chosen on the basis of I've got a group of friends that they might not like my Christian values and priorities and principles. I've got a lot of friends that aren't Christians. And to do this, live in a way that's loyal to God, they might not like that. And it may cause some friction in my relationships with them. And there have been times that because I have feared the loss of those relationships, I have made choices that betray my real loyalties to the person that I call my Lord. See, here's the thing. One of the ways to think about this is that's so important is maybe you've heard that word apostasy, and that word apostasy is, you know, you break faith with something, and in one sense, you know, you might say, well, we make choices sometimes that break our loyalties to certain things, and you might have a set of rules or regulations that you use to kind of guide and govern your life. And on the one hand, you might go, well, it's not such a big deal to break those rules because I'm more interested in relationships. But here's the way to think about this in terms of our loyalty to Christ. See, when you break faith as a Christian, you're not breaking some arbitrary set of rules that are laid out for us. Because here's the thing, being a Christian is not about following a bunch of rules and regulations. Being a Christian is about understanding that Jesus came from heaven, came down, lived as a man, died on the cross to forgive you for your sins, and you forfeit your own life to make him the Lord. My life was bought with a price, and I belong to Jesus. So when I choose to deny or reject my loyalty to Christ, I'm rejecting not a set of rules, but what am I rejecting? I'm rejecting a person. I'm rejecting God and what he's done for me, and what he's done to buy me at a price. And that's a whole different thing than just breaking a bunch of rules, isn't it? Now, that's a big deal, and that's why this stuff is important. Now, see, here's the thing. I think that there's times in life where we were so desperate that our real allegiance becomes clear, and that's a good thing. It helps you know what you're really living for, and it helps you know whether or not you really... they use this term, you know, are you smoking what you're selling, right? In terms of people who might sell a certain product that you might smoke. If you're going to sell it to other people, are you willing to use it yourself? See, and if I'm going to tell other people about how great God is, you might ask me, are you living what you're trying to convince other people that God is so great? Is there real evidence that the stuff that I say is true? Desperation and those moments of great fear, we can look at our lives and I think it gives us a great opportunity to examine. Is my loyalty really with the person of Christ? Is it really with God? Do I really go to Him when it matters most? It's a great test for us. And I think God allows those things just for that purpose, because it's worth finding out and not playing a game with. The last thing in here is notice that this desperation brings him to a place where he's not pretending anymore. He knows, I can't do anything about this. My friends can't do anything about this. I don't have the money to have anybody else do anything to help me out here. He finally comes to a place where that veneer of, I can make it through life on my own ability. He comes to that place where he goes, hey, you know what? If this is going to work out, it's just because you're God and you're in control. And he's not playing any games. That's why he comes and begs. He realizes who's God and the only person who's got any hope of really helping him. And that's a good thing. See, if you want to experience, I'm convinced of this, if you really want to experience God's power in your life, you can't come to him and go, well, hey, I'm pretty good looking. Or say, you know, I've got all this money and these resources, God, that would be so neat for you to use. You know, whatever it is that you think you can bring to God that he can use for his kingdom, he may very well use those things. But here's the bottom line. If you come to God and you just say, I'm willing to be yours. Take me as I am, with all my gifts and abilities and talents, but also with all my flaws. And you know what? I'm willing to be used by you. That's genuine humility. And that's coming and saying, I'm not going to set the agenda. I'm not going to tell you how how this should work out. It's just saying, you're the boss. See, that's how he created us to live. He's in a place where we're willing to yield ourselves completely to his authority. And I'm convinced that if you want to experience God's power in your life, you have to come humbly to him. It doesn't work any other way. In the midst of this, now Jairus is thrilled because he's moving along and Jesus is coming with him. In the midst of this, there was a woman there who'd been subject to bleeding for 12 years. And she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors. And so she had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. Why would she think, everybody else comes to Jesus and yells and screams for his attention. This woman does something very different. Why would she believe that touching his clothes would be of any use to her? Interesting. Verse 28, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. This causes an interesting conversation that Jesus has with the people around him. At once, Jesus realized that the power had gone out of him. This is that word, dynamite. Jesus realizes that something, and here's the funny thing. You wonder, well, did Jesus do the healing here? Well, you'd go, yeah, of course, he's God. He's the one who does this. But Jesus tells her later on that it was her faith that made her well. So was it Jesus' power or her faith? We have these arguments about, you know, who's in control of things. Is God predestined? Is he in control of everything? Or do we have free will? Well, maybe at least in this particular passage, it may remind us that sometimes it seems like it's both, you know, that God's got both these things going on at once. It's not one or the other, but both. He turned around in the crowd and he asked, who touched my clothes? Now, Jesus obviously knows. He's obviously trying to use this as a teaching moment, and it will be a powerful teaching moment. We'll find out. You see the people crowding against you. I'm sure his disciples are indignant with him. His disciples answered, and yet you can ask, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear. Why would she be afraid, do you think? And she told him the whole truth. He said to her, daughter. Notice he didn't just call her, hey, woman. He calls her daughter. He's going to help somebody else who is a father heal her daughter. How does Jesus view this woman? Daughter. Your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. And that's interesting because the suffering there is not just the physical suffering. Here's this woman who is desperate, and this, you know, why would she be afraid? And why would Jesus? Because he's got a threat that is, you know, the woman's condition is bad and needs to be dealt with, but this daughter is it would seem like it's the emergency situation. You know, it's like the ambulance rushing to the hospital, and the ambulance pulls over because, you know, the kid has fallen off and skinned up his knee. It's not that that's not bad, but it's like, hey, you've got someone in the ambulance that's more important. What are you doing here? Now, you and I may go, hey, Jesus is being nice to this lady who needs real help. But stop for a minute and think about Jairus. I'm not real happy about this interruption. We're going somewhere, and we need to keep moving. Why are we stopping? Come back and deal with this later. Talk about this later. And, you know, at least one thing that's going on here is, if you're going to get something from God, I don't think God allows us just to do it secretly. If we're going to get something from him, we need to recognize. We don't covertly go to God, get something, and then go hide. God doesn't operate like that. We have to come clean with what's going on. But here's the thing. This woman is fearful, and she should be, of judgment, because she has broken the rules. See, the rules say that if you are in her condition, and whether it's the fault of her own or not, and obviously she's done everything she can to try and alleviate this bleeding that she has, this perpetual bleeding problem, that she was unclean and she couldn't touch other people. And you couldn't touch her even accidentally, because it would make you ceremonially unclean. And you'd have to go through all these hoops to become clean, to be able to go to synagogue, to be able to be around your family and stuff like that. And this is what she realizes. She realizes, I got what I wanted, but I'm not sure now that I face Jesus that the means, me sneaking in through the crowd, that was her means to get the ends that she was looking for. What were the ends? To be healed. She's not sure that the means justified the ends. And she's afraid that when she gets exposed, that Jesus may say, hey, look, I understand what you're doing was a good thing, but you just defiled a whole bunch of people. And you defiled me. Because the law says I can't touch people who are unclean. And so she's afraid that she's going to come under judgment for hopping over the rules here. And so this, what's interesting about this is, before we talk about Jesus' reaction, is think about, why does she do this? Because she one of the things that she does that I think is so good for us to remember is she actually believes what the Bible says. Isn't that a funny thing? She's like, the Messiah, he's coming, and there's real power in him, even in his clothes. And it's funny because desperation does this to us, doesn't it? Desperation leads us through, we'll do what she did. She spent all her other resources. Every other option she expelled, none of them helped her. In fact, she got worse over these 12 years. And she finally says, well, maybe what the Bible, you know, maybe what the Old Testament says is true. And it's funny, I wonder how much easier we'd make it on our own lives if we just decided, before we try everything else, before we expend every other resource, what if we decided to try what the Scripture says first? I wonder if we could alleviate some of the pain we experience in our own lives as a result of that. A great lesson in here that she teaches us is, you know what, even if you have expended everything, even if you've said, maybe later, God, I'll try this, and then finally you've tried everything, you go, God, help me! You know, God doesn't go, no, you've tried too many other things, and you've gone too far, it's too late for you. He doesn't do that, does he? Man, isn't that the good news about God and how he deals with us? He doesn't hold a grudge. You know, and it's never too late. This woman reminds us of, this is the whole story of the thief on the cross. The guy's on the cross, he's not getting down, he's not going to do anything good for God tomorrow, is he? No matter what he's done up to that point, he throws himself on the mercy and compassion of God, just like this woman does. And God doesn't deal with them harshly. It doesn't mean that all the consequences were alleviated. The guy still dies on the cross, right? But he met God, and God dealt with him with compassion and mercy. And that's certainly what she finds out here also. Jesus meets her and deals with her out of that place of compassion and mercy first. Daughter. The last thing is her faith, it's empowered her to push all the other obstacles, physical and other relational, out of the way to be able to get from God. And this is that idea about faith, is real faith moves us to action, even when the cards are down, even when it's difficult. Real faith encourages us to step up and push through whatever boundaries are holding us back. Great news for this woman. Are you kidding me? Unbelievable. What a great lesson we have. Thankfully, we have this parenthesis in the story. What a great blessing, the moment of freedom she's been looking for so long. And in the midst of this, bad news for Jairus. While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? I don't know if he was frustrated, angry, ticked at Jesus. I don't know how he reacted, but it couldn't, she's got her moment of victory, and he's just got the knife in the heart, man. Jesus says to him, though, ignore what they say, Jesus told the synagogue ruler. Don't be afraid, just believe. He didn't let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? The child's not dead, but asleep. Now, this doesn't mean that the child wasn't really dead, but what Jesus is, he's using an illustration to say that her condition, it's a temporary one. How did people react to this? They laughed at him. Have you ever in your life, shared with somebody who might not be a Christian, have you ever shared about something that's really exciting about what God is doing or has done in your life, and people's reaction might not be filled with enthusiasm? Have you ever had people laugh at you or, mock you, ridicule you because of your faith? It's not, you're in good company. People had a hard time believing Jesus face to face, and they laughed at him too. It's not an uncommon, it's not always easy to believe and to hear what God says is true. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and he went in there where the child was. He took her by the hand and he told her, Talitha koum, which in Aramaic it means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Didn't take her a minute. Didn't take her 5 minutes. Didn't take her a couple seconds. Immediately, just like with the woman when she touched Jesus. Immediately. This is the thing about Jesus. I put a great quote in your bulletins about, hey man, wherever Jesus went, things changed right then, right? This was the thing about him. There was instantaneous reaction, good, bad, or ugly. The girl stood up and walked around. She's 12 years old. Why would he put that in there? It's funny because the woman was subject to bleeding for 12 years. How many tribes of Israel are there? 12. How many disciples are there? 12. Could it be that there's something significant about that number that he's trying to remind us of? See, that number 12 is a picture of renewal or change. And so God is and called out the 12 tribes of Israel. He's called out a new people to himself. The 12 disciples represent that God is giving new people a new opportunity. I'm not saying this is why, but I'm just curious. Is that why there is renewal going on in here? Amazing stories in here. Jairus goes from being crushed, I'm sure, to living in absolute astonishment and amazement about what Jesus has done. A couple things just thinking about this for us, kind of a big stepping back and looking at these four stories that we've walked through and seen the big picture in closing. First of all, you know what? Fear in life, I've lived long enough now that, when you're a teenager, most of us think, hey, well, I'm never going to die and life's going to be great. And if there is any pain or hurt, it shouldn't be like that. Everything should be rosy and, everything should be great. Well, I've lived long enough to understand that it's not a question of whether you're going to have real desperation in your life. It's not a question of whether you're not going to be confronted with overwhelming fear in your life. Everybody has those moments. It's not a question of if. You'll all have them. And in those moments, it's a great opportunity to discover where are your real loyalties? What do you really believe? Where does your real faith lie? Do you really go to God for those things? This last week, I had just one of the highlights of my year so far. Every week here, we've got a great children's program that Lori runs, and there's stuff, obviously during Sundays, but also midweek for our kids here. And my son, Levi, who's 12 years old, this last week, he got to share his testimony about what God's done in his life. So I snuck downstairs and sat in the back there, and he's in front of all the whole class and all the teachers, and he's been, you know, he wrote it down, and he's been practicing at home, and it's been cool to listen to him and stuff like that. And he gets up there, and he gets the microphone, and he goes, it's like this. It was awesome. Poor kid was so nervous. But he starts reading his testimony, and I've heard it enough times to know that he's so nervous he's getting words wrong and punctuation out of place. He's just kind of going off memory. But it was, you know what, as a dad, man, it was beautiful to be able to hear him talk about the church and Jesus and what Jesus has meant in his life. And about halfway through, I got up my iPhone. I go, I got to record this. Yeah. And I got about half of it. And fortunately, Lori records the whole thing, so I get a tape of it. And I'm going to, when he's 16 years old, because he's going to be 16, I'm going to show him that tape, because I know how kids are. But if you fast for long enough to see what happened, that sweet little 12-year-old, something happens, you know, it's like, grow up. I'm going to remind him of what he said. But my biggest fear in life was that I've had, biggest moment of desperation I had in my life was associated with I've got 5 kids, and Levi was my first of those kids. And my biggest moment of fear and desperation I've had in my life, where I was just in a place where I was desperate for God to come through for me, was when we were in the hospital on the night when Levi was born. We'd been in the hospital a number of hours, and we were having trouble getting his heartbeat on the external monitor, so they did an internal monitor, and I noticed, you know, it was about 1 o'clock at night, and I noticed that things were changing. And I didn't know whether it was the monitor slipping. I didn't know what was going on, but his heart rate was going down and down and down, and it wasn't just in relation to Heather's contractions. And so I got nervous and started talking with the nurse, and obviously she wasn't going to tell me a whole lot of information. But the doctor came, you know, took about an hour and a half to get there, and it was getting lower and lower and lower, and I felt totally helpless. The nurse couldn't do anything to help. And my fear is there's umbilical cord wrapped around his neck. I didn't know. And there was nothing I could do to make things better. And I couldn't, you know, I didn't want to scare Heather, so I wasn't talking to her about it. And man, I was scared to death. And I cried out to God, because I was like, I'd like to be able to do something here. I hope the doctors can do something. But I sort of felt like for the first time in my life, really, as a Christian, I was like, you know what? What's going to happen here really doesn't depend on me or my ability. Or I think I even was like, hey, thank God for doctors and nurses and hospitals. But really, at the end of the day and the end of this night right now that I'm working through, this really is... This is in your hands, God. And I beg you to come through for me here. And you know, I didn't know what God was going to do, but here was the thing. You know what? When I was in that moment, and I've rarely experienced this since, in that moment, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I had this weird sense of, it's okay. I had this peace that, you know what? It's okay. Because God is in control. And I'm not. And that's the thing. See, I think a lot of times we freak out in life because we think we're in control, or we think somebody else is in control other than God. And in doing that, you know, we think we can leverage the situation to turn out the way we want it to. And that's just a veneer. The reality is God is God, and we don't know how things are going to turn out. And I don't know how to explain it other than just to say that the piece of really coming to grips with the being, I think, maybe just honest about the situation allowed me to have this kind of peace through the thing. Well, obviously, things worked out very fortunately for us, and I was probably fearful to a degree that I did not need to be. But, man, I was scared to death, and I don't know I've ever had that level of anxiety ever before in my life. I look at those two people, and I look tired and really bad in that picture. I didn't tell my wife I was going to put this up because she would have killed me. But, you know, things turned out really, really well for us, and God was very good. But the point of the story is not the conclusion. The point of the story is what I found was getting to that place where I was willing to confess and come humbly and recognize, this is yours, God. It's not mine. And that's what allowed me to have peace to make it through. The other major part of the story is that what we see in these stories and so many others is that faith isn't an abstract idea, but it's something that really is alive and works in our life and is demonstrated by the choices that we make. And sometimes those choices are very hard and have consequences. I love this woman. I'm not the biggest guy in the world. In fact, I'm wearing shorts. I don't like wearing shorts because I got chicken legs. That was one of my nicknames in high school. It's one of the few nicknames I can share in church that I had. But I'm not the biggest guy in the world. And so, like, you know, if I need to go somewhere, you know, I see Mo over here. Mo, you're a big guy. Stand up for me. Stand up, Mo. If I need to go somewhere, you know what? I can hide behind Mo. Mo can push people out of the way for me. I'm using Mo, right? But this woman, she knew how to throw elbows, right? I mean, she was pushing the chairs back, walking over them. Nothing was going to stop her. No physical object was going to stop her from getting to where she wanted to go. And, you know, that's the thing about faith. Faith allows us to push through where otherwise we might just give up hope. Faith is a great motivator in terms of our relationships, but also our, you know, real physical barriers that sometimes life throws up for us. And that's a great reminder for us in this story. How about this? You know, notice that Jesus, you know, Jesus' ministry calendar was really full, and yet he still had time for this woman. He wasn't going to let her get away with just getting something for God for free and not having to admit where she got her healing from and where it all came from. In life, you know, wouldn't, as a pastor, wouldn't it be nice if just like, you know, I could go to work at 9 and be done at 5 and you know, if people had a problem, they could just call me between 9 and 5 and that's it. You know, you got a sickness, a health, a death, call me and make sure it happens within those hours, right? But life doesn't work out like that. And see, here's the thing about these stories is God's timing is just never our own. And Jairus was, I'm sure, ticked off that like, hey, wait a minute here, God, I've got a schedule. Thank you for meeting me and walking with me to help my daughter. And then an interruption comes along and he's not happy about it. God's got this weird thing that his time, the way he works things out, is rarely ours. And it's frustrating for Jairus. It's frustrating for me. I'm sure it's frustrating for you. But see, in this story, we find out that Jesus' ministry is not limited to going from point A to point B. That ministry happens along the way. You know, I was a youth pastor for 15 years, and people would always say, well, you know, isn't going to camp great and, you know, doing youth group and all that kind of stuff fantastic? You know, the best times of ministry, hands down, the most profitable times I had were not the times at camp. Were not Sunday school or great lessons I had on Wednesday night. Inevitably, the best times of ministry I had were in the van on the way to camp or on the way home from a trip. But it wasn't those planned ministry. I've got a great lesson planned. This is going to be great. God's really going to use this. The best moments of ministry that I've had in my life have been ones that were not on my 9-to-5. They were not on my calendar. They were not on my schedule. And sometimes those things are very taxing for us. But here's the thing. See, if you're willing to live in that regard and say, you know what, my life and my time, even my schedule is yours, Lord, and help me to be aware of when I can be used, because it might not fall in, you know, if you serve in the church, let's say, and you serve in the Sunday school department, and you think, that's where I do my ministry. No. You do ministry everywhere all the time, and you just never know where God is going to use you. And this is a great lesson. Jesus, this is how Jesus lived, and that's how we as his people ought to live too. And it's not primarily for ourselves. See, the beneficiary was blessed far more than the person than Jesus giving that away. And that's true for us too. If we're willing to be available to other people, God will use us, but he can use us to be a huge blessing to other people too if we're not too busy. Last thing in here is people always find that they get more from Jesus than what they expect. And man, you know, when I first, you know, committed my life to Christ, all I wanted in high school, you know, as a sophomore in high school, I just wanted to know that I could be forgiven for all the stuff I had done. I sort of felt like, God, just let me know that I'm forgiven, and I promise I'll go hide away and try and get my life together, you know. And man, oh man, I've following Jesus and allowing him to be Lord and shape my life has been amazing. Far more than I ever bargained for. Not just in a good way, but it's been real challenging too. See, and here's the thing. These stories are great because we love it. They have a happy ending. But not every story has a happy ending in the Bible. The disciples are going to find this out in their own lives. Almost every one of them is going to die a horrible, painful death. Jesus doesn't necessarily get what his wish was in the garden. We don't always get what we want from God. And see, if that's just your motivation, it's just to get what you want and not just to get God, you're after the wrong thing. See, the story, I think the best part of these two stories, I think the best part of these four stories that we've read the last couple of weeks is what Jesus says to the woman, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go and be at peace with God." Jesus wasn't just interested in delivering physical healing. This 12-year-old girl, I don't know how long she lived, but she does die. Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. But guess what? Lazarus is an old guy. He's going to die anyways. It's great. It's wonderful. But it's still temporary. Right? It was a one-time wonderful event. But see, what God offers us on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis is just what he told that woman. Peace. And that peace is that Jewish word shalom. And it means be at rest. You can live at peace and be at rest in your relationship to God, and you can be at peace in your relationship to other people. And that's the promise that Jesus offers us, both for today and ultimately for all of eternity. My peace I give you, not as the world gives, Jesus said. I wonder if maybe one of the best things we can take away from this is just to take the example of the woman and believe what the Bible says. It tells us, cast all your cares on him, and he will lift you up. But Jesus, we can have genuine peace with God and with other people. He's big enough for us to be able to cast all of our cares, all of our desperations, all of our fears on. And he can alleviate those things and give us the rest that we need. May you go this week and may you live at peace with God. If our ushers will come forward, we'll have our offering and continue our worship here. Thanks for your faithfulness. It allows us to do all the things we do here, not only on Sunday, but throughout the week. And I hope you guys have a great week and live at peace with God this week.